This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we explore the challenges for kids of leaving home with sickle cell disease, plus the latest breakthroughs in treating cancer in children. But first, what is gluten sensitivity and what can be done about it? Celiac disease, an inherited autoimmune digestive disease, sometimes known as SPRU, has been on the rise. And since 1974 in the United States, the rate of celiac disease has doubled every 15 years. Today, celiac disease affects at least 3 million Americans. But in addition, many more Americans have discovered that they may have a gluten sensitivity. And here with more on this is Diana Stuber, registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at the Joslin Diabetes Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Diana. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So let's begin by explaining a little bit more about what celiac disease is. Tell us more about it.
Well, as you mentioned, celiac disease is an autoimmune condition. And in autoimmune disease, the immune system, our body's own defense mechanism, attacks a part of our body. In celiac disease, it attacks the small intestine. And that can lead to malabsorption or not being able to absorb the nutrition that you eat.
And that's all in response to something called
gluten.
Gluten. And tell us what gluten is.
Gluten is a protein that's found in wheat and barley and rye. And those are, especially wheat, is very common in our diet. And gluten triggers that autoimmune response that damages the small intestine.
So anyone who has this celiac disease actually will be, by eating things with gluten, will eventually be causing damage long-term to their small intestine.
That's true.
But in the short term, there are symptoms that we see that go along with this celiac disease. Tell us about those.
Well, some people don't have any symptoms at all. About half of people with celiac disease don't really know they have it, don't have any symptoms. And the symptoms can be, they're not so specific to just celiac disease. They can include abdominal pain, distension, bloating, diarrhea.
Can there also be constipation? I mean, there can be
it can be a vague kind of thing. And sometimes it takes people years before they're actually diagnosed. They may have been going to the doctor for 7 to 11 years.
And are we also seeing this in children as well as in adults these days?
Well, originally it was considered to be just a disease in children. But over the last probably 30 years, 20 to 30 years, a lot of research has been done, and they've discovered that it can happen at any age. And sometimes people have had it for many, many years, so they've already suffered some of those longer-term consequences, which include things like osteoporosis, which is a quite debilitating thing as we get older.
And the osteoporosis is because they haven't been absorbing what they need, the proper nutrients, as a result of the damage to the small intestine?
Correct.
So it's pretty serious disease, and it sounds to me like it's difficult to diagnose.
It's getting better.
Because the only reason I say that is because it may mimic other disease entities by the description of what you've just, the symptoms that you've described.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. People go to the doctor because they have diarrhea, and it's not the first thing that the doctor will think of. Sometimes when people have no symptoms, it may be something like anemia, which is also related to poor absorption of nutrients. And it can take some time to eliminate other causes for those symptoms.
So bottom line is people really can be asymptomatic and still have this problem?
Yes.
Well, that gets to the key question here then. How do you diagnose it? Or how does one really know if they have it?
Well, certainly if somebody has symptoms, they would talk to their doctor. And if another cause can't be found for those symptoms, then they might be sent to a gastroenterologist. And those are specialists that can help identify what the problem is. Other times people are tested, it's kind of a screening. So celiac disease is more common when people have other autoimmune conditions.
So they kind of run in clusters.
Yes, Yeah. So if somebody has type 1 diabetes, for example, we're now screening for celiac disease on a routine basis.
And others like rheumatoid arthritis, perhaps, or an other kind of autoimmune diseases like that.
Yes.
Yep. So how is the diagnosis made?
Well, it's done initially through that screening, which is a blood test, and they look for some autoantibodies. And then if those levels are positive, then people are referred to a gastroenterologist if they haven't been already. And it's confirmed with a biopsy. That's still considered the gold standard. So doing an upper GI series where they, they take a look at the stomach and then they go into the intestine. They take several small samples of tissue in the small intestine, and then they look at it under a microscope. And if they can see the damage, then it's a diagnosis of celiac disease.
So those two things, both the blood test and the little biopsy together, make up the diagnosis, and they're pretty definitive at that point.
Yes, they are.
So why are we hearing so much? I mean, I did say in the beginning that there's more and more of this around. First of all, do you have any sense of why that might be?
There are several theories. It could be just that wheat is in so many more foods, but wheat by itself doesn't cause celiac disease. Celiac disease depends on a person's genetic makeup. So that has to be part of it, as well as exposure to gluten. But also there's this theory of something called the hygiene hypothesis, which is that we're so careful about not exposing ourselves to germs and things that we may have been exposed to hundreds, thousands of years ago that help prepare us to not be confused in that way. Our body, immune system, to not be
so
confused.
So we become more sensitive to things rather than more immune to things, so
yes.
to speak. We don't have
yeah.
the practice. Our body doesn't have the practice basically
exactly.
dealing with these things.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Link on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with registered dietitian Diana Stuber. We're talking about celiac disease, but also gluten sensitivity. So there's all of this stuff, everywhere about gluten-free. You walk down a supermarket aisle, and you just see all these signs, this is gluten-free and that's gluten-free. So more and more people are concerned about this. Tell us what the difference is between celiac disease, true disease, and gluten sensitivity?
Well, gluten sensitivity or intolerance is actually kind of a spectrum, where celiac disease is at the far end of that spectrum, where there's actual physical damage to the body. Gluten sensitivity may manifest itself in some of the same symptoms. So people can have diarrhea, bloating. They can also they describe it as feeling brain fog, where they're just feeling fatigued, they're not able to concentrate well. But there is no physical damage that's been found to this point.
So if they were to do a biopsy, they wouldn't find any damage to the small intestine.
That's true. And so the diagnosis of gluten sensitivity is really more a diagnosis of exclusion. You look to find any other source for those symptoms, including celiac disease. And if you can't, then a person might try what we call an elimination diet, where they avoid gluten for several months because it can take some time for the gluten, the effects to dissipate, if you will, to go away. So they would eliminate gluten, see how they feel. If they feel better, that's good. If they then reintroduce the gluten and they feel crummy again, then then it's worth following a gluten-free diet.
So bottom line is, you're saying there are a lot of these kind of almost, I hate to use this term, but amorphous kind of symptoms or hard to pin down symptoms, like you said, this brain fog, or even things I've read, things like anxiety, depression, mood swings, even ADD, they've said, could be in part a response to some degree of gluten sensitivity. I guess it's hard to prove. But as a result, more and more people are deciding to take that path, which is the treatment of choice, I guess, for either celiac or gluten sensitivity, is basically eliminate gluten from their diet.
That's right.
How hard is that to do these days with it? As you've just alluded to, it seems to be everywhere.
It's getting easier. It is difficult, and there's a lot of good information online, but things that are online can become outdated. The federal government just passed a new labeling law where there are rules now for what is considered gluten-free. So if a company says their product is gluten-free, they have to be able to show that they've tested that food and that it has less than 20 parts per million of gluten.
So it's verifiable.
Yes.
And that does include, obviously, where it's being produced, in a factory it's been produced in, and all of those kinds of things. They really
Correct.
Have to be, they're held to a standard these days.
Yes.
And in your experience, well, first let me ask you this. Do you think people need professional help in terms of arriving at a nutritionally balanced gluten-free diet?
I think that to optimize, you know, the nutritional value, that a dietitian is very important. There are a lot of gluten-free foods available. Some of them, for example, some of the bread products are not fortified with iron and B vitamins like they are with the wheat products. So people can miss out on nutrients if they're not careful. And if it's, I think, recommended to visit with a dietitian.
So if you should consider yourself gluten sensitive, or if your doctor agrees that you may be gluten sensitive, or an appointment with a registered dietitian is always a good idea.
I think it's a good idea. I think one of our problems these days is that your insurance may not pay for that.
Okay, well, obviously those are the things people have to work on or work out individually, but clearly it's not a bad idea. Anyway, is it an overwhelming task to try to figure out what is gluten-free in the environment, or now with all the labeling, you think it's a lot easier?
I think it's a lot easier than it used to be.
Go ahead.
So people do still have to be, I think the challenge is not so much at the grocery store as I think it is when you're eating out, when you're eating at a friend's house, those kind of things. And so, again, working with a dietitian can help you develop some strategies for figuring out what to do in those situations.
Yeah, it might not be so apparent, as you said, in prepared foods or in circumstances like where you have less control, to really know what is, where the gluten is, and especially, as you said, it's now in many products that we wouldn't expect to find it in.
That's right.
So it's very interesting that we have it on the rise. It's very interesting that people are becoming more aware of it, and hopefully more and more people will find that by following a gluten-free diet, perhaps they can eliminate these symptoms. But the bottom line is, if you have gluten sensitivity, you will not necessarily suffer the long-term consequences.
Nope. That happens only with celiac disease.
Very good. Well, thanks. That really clarified it for me. I appreciate your coming in. My guest has been Diana Stuber, registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Upstate's Joslin Diabetes Center. Coming up next, the challenges of leaving home for college with sickle cell disease. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. More than 70,000 Americans have sickle cell anemia. Historically, the average lifespan for people with sickle cell disease was only 14 years. But today, with the new treatments available, life expectancy can reach to more than 50 years of age. So today, kids are going off to college with this disease, and there are real concerns about their life away from home. And here with more on this is Dr. Richard Sills, professor of pediatrics and the division chief of pediatric hematology and oncology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Sills.
Great
Thanks
to be
for
here.
Coming. So children with sickle cell anemia are living longer. Tell us why that is.
Part of it is better supportive care, physicians being more aware of the complications of sickle cell disease. We now are developing some treatments that are not yet cures, but are improving the health of our kids, and we are beginning to use bone marrow transplantation as a possible cure in some patients.
So basically, these kids, where kids were dying, I guess, 30, 40 years ago at about age 14, that would be the longest they could live. Now they really are living into maturity.
Oh, over 95% of children with sickle cell disease will grow up today to be adults.
Wow. Help us understand it. Tell us exactly what is sickle cell.
It's an inherited disorder passed on from parents who most often carry a trait that they may often not even be aware that they have that affects your red blood cells and allows those cells, under certain circumstances, to block blood vessels, which can cause pain and, depending where the blockage is, loss of function.
So the parent themselves may not have any symptoms or the disease, but if they, is it like a recessive trait? In other words, two parents with that recessive trait might end up with an offspring?
Exactly. In most cases, the parents have what's called sickle cell trait, which affects about 1 in 10 people of African descent in this country, and many people of Hispanic descent, and occasionally people of European descent. And if both parents have that trait and they will have no symptoms of it and not know they have it unless they're tested, they have a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with sickle cell disease.
Right. And what happens to the red blood cells? I mean, why do they call it sickle cell?
If one thinks about the sickle on the old Russian or communist flag,
like the scythe.
It was the scythe that would cut wheat, and the cells actually form that shape. And you can see it under the microscope. So 100 years ago, when it was first recognized, it was these changes in the shape of the red blood cells that led to the name of the disease.
So who, you mentioned 1 in 12 or 1 in 10 African Americans are at risk, as well as Hispanics?
1 in 10 African Americans are at risk of having the trait, being well but passing it on. 1 in 400 people of African descent will have the disease. It's less common in Hispanics, but certainly does occur, and it does occur in some European populations, especially Southern European.
How does it actually affect people, though? Let's say you're a child born with sickle cell. What is it, you know, how does it manifest itself?
Well, it's a complicated disease. The most common manifestation are unpredictable and at times very severe episodes of pain that usually last a few days, and then everything kind of goes back to baseline. But there are multiple other complications that can affect our kids. They are at risk of strokes. They are at risk of lung disease, they're at risk of kidney disease, visual loss, and many other complications for which they need to be monitored and, if necessary, treated.
Is that because the shape of the blood cells or the way that they function block blood vessels and create problems for what otherwise would be normal functioning?
They will block the blood vessels, and also the red cells do not live as long as normal red cells, so these patients are also anemic, which is why it's called sickle cell anemia.
And the point is, how would you recognize it as, you know, you're a parent of a new baby and they're not, will they already be screened? I mean,
yes.
That's the question. Is it a routine kind of thing to know that you have the trait pretty much? Is that part of your obstetrical evaluation so that they know and then they look out for the fact that your child may be born with it?
Well, it's really two parts. First, every baby born in the United States is tested for sickle cell disease. So parents will be notified within about 2 weeks of birth if they have a child with sickle cell disease. The other question is, are women during pregnancy being tested to find out if they have sickle cell trait? And then if they do, have their partner tested so that the obstetrician will know that that family is at risk of having a child with sickle cell disease, and that family has options as long as they know.
So both of those things do occur, you're saying? I mean, the babies are all tested, and often the mothers are tested?
The mothers should be tested. They usually are. But the genetics is complicated, and at times it can be missed.
I see. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Dr. Richard Sills. He's a professor of pediatrics and the division chief for pediatric hematology and oncology. And we're talking about kids with sickle cell anemia and the concerns that we have for them about leaving home for college. So you've talked about pain and other potential complications, maybe high risk for infection. So you got a kid who's going away from home for the first time in many cases. What do parents have to be worried about, or what does the student have to be worried about?
They really do have to prepare. First of all, as simple as it sounds, parents have to make sure that their child's health care and health insurance will carry over where they go to school, especially if they're leaving the state. Probably most important, they need to contact the sickle cell center closest to where the child's going to go to school, at least young adult is going to go to school, so that center is aware that there's a new patient in the area and that they can begin to communicate so that if there is a problem, it can be efficiently managed, because that's important to prevent complications from getting
worse. So what exactly do they have to be worried about? I mean, what could happen? What are the kinds of things that
they could
happen?
Have an episode of severe pain, which is not going to be managed with routine or oral medication. They could quickly develop pneumonia. They could develop a stroke. And that would require urgent medical care. It's very important that these children be seen at centers experienced in taking care of patients with sickle cell disease, because otherwise their management really does get impaired. So at Upstate, we have the advantage of being the only center in the whole central New York and northern Pennsylvania region that takes care of children with sickle cell disease. And we can assure that these children will get the best possible therapy. And that's really critical if they get sick.
So you're really suggesting that if a parent, a family is sending a child away to a different state or a school even not that far away, that perhaps they should make contact with a center or some like organization, medical center?
Yeah. They should find out where the nearest sickle cell center is, and they should be speaking to that center before that kid ever goes away to college to make sure that the child knows where the health center is at school, that health center is aware there's a student who has sickle cell disease, that their appropriate plans are made if the child is sick and requires care at the center. Those are issues. It's speed care. And for these children, when they have a complication, getting care started sooner is going to let them be healthier and decrease the risk of life-threatening complications.
How about things like having your medical records forwarded so that the center is really prepared, knows who's coming, so to speak?
Well, that's part of that appointment. If we know about the student coming, we make sure that the records come so we understand exactly what form of sickle cell disease they have, what kind of complication they've had, and again, are better prepared if a complication arises.
You know, when kids first go away to school, there's so many new experiences, and they're exposed to so much that they may have been exposed to in high school, but more so in college. They have this new sense of freedom. How do things like drug use, potentially, lack of sleep, high pressure stress management, or alcohol for that matter, how do they impact on a kid with sickle cell?
It can increase the risk of complications. Alcohol tends to cause you to get dehydrated, which is a very bad thing for patients with sickle cell disease. Getting too exhausted is an issue. They need to have that experience. They need to get away from their parents and start to live their lives, but they also have to learn that they have an issue. And this is always a problem. Adolescents always feel that they're invulnerable, that nothing will happen to them. And that, unfortunately, when they have sickle cell disease, increases the risk that problems will not get recognized nor treated as quickly, which increases the difficulty, ultimately, in managing these patients.
So it's kind of the first step toward adulthood, in a sense. They have to really recognize they have a problem, they have a disease, and they need to be responsible for themselves and making sure they have adequate help lined up, and maybe that they be more responsible in some of these behaviors we've talked about, that they may need more sleep or they may need to watch out for that, and they need to recognize that alcohol usage could be deleterious to their overall health.
Absolutely, but unfortunately, 18-year-olds, now legally adults, do not always act like adults, and it's an issue. They need to be seeing an eye doctor every year, and as they get out of out from under their parents' wings, that needs to happen. It's easy to forget, but if they fail to see that eye doctor every year, they can have partial or even complete visual loss.
In your experience, do you think the schools have been helpful, the colleges and what have you, have been helpful in making those contacts or helping, you know, promote that kind of coverage, umbrella-like coverage?
I think most schools try to help. The issue is, does the school know? And that's where that first visit to a center before school allows us to say, we'll call the school, we'll talk to the school. They'll understand what we're going to do. And that's really important.
How about things like choosing a roommate? In other words, is that a consideration for a student? Or should they be alerting a roommate to the fact that they have this disease and that there may be certain sequelae or certain problems that they may find, you know, occurring for them?
I think that's difficult. At this age, kids don't want to admit their illness. And most of the complications of sickle cell disease, they're going to happen slow enough that they could ask for help and arrange to get help. So I think that's a tougher one, because kids don't want the world to know, and they can probably work around that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I had the opportunity to interview another of your colleagues about kids going away to school with diabetes. And in that case, it can be life-threatening, and moments can make a difference. And in that case, it seemed like it was more important perhaps to alert a roommate to the potential of some kind of a diabetes crisis or something. But in this case, you're saying it pretty well can be handled by the student, assuming they have good, they have made good connection with other medical professionals.
Yeah, I think the number of times that we would expect something to be that abrupt would be much, much less common compared to a student with diabetes.
So overall, your best advice is be prepared, make contact with some health center near to the school, and be aware that you have a problem and what the possible dangers could be.
Absolutely. It's all about beginning to take personal responsibility.
I'll leave it at that. Thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Richard Sills, professor of pediatrics and the division chief of pediatric hematology and oncology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. If you're like me, you experience at least one snack attack every day. And these could wreak havoc on a healthy diet if we're not careful. Well, here with me for this week's Healthy Eats segment is Upstate Registered Dietitian Terry Podolak with the skinny on all of this. Mm-hmm. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Hi, Linda. Good, thanks.
So we're all prone to snacking. In fact, I've been told that it can even be healthy for you. Why are snacks an important part of a healthy diet?
Well, I think there's three reasons. One, especially for children, it helps them meet their nutrient needs. We have our children getting back to school, and if they're playing sports, they need some snacks in between. It also may help with growth and giving them, again, that extra nutrition for growth and for paying attention at school. Another reason is that if you're truly hungry between meals, that it helps to satisfy your hunger and helps prevent overeating at your meals. And the third reason, I think, is that for some of us, we have better digestion if we eat smaller, more frequent meals, so including those couple snacks in between.
Yeah, I actually have read that if you want to lose weight, you might, instead of having your three majors, to have five minors.
Absolutely.
Meals during the day.
Absolutely, because again, it helps you, I think, to control your intake, your overall caloric intake. You're not overeating. You're not getting so ravenously hungry that you tend to overeat a larger meal.
Yeah, and you may even think in terms of smaller meals in general. I mean, you almost retrain your mind, retrain your stomach, retrain your whole kind
exactly.
of approach to food to have smaller meals. So snacks clearly can help there.
And they say it can help with your metabolism also.
So what makes with a healthy choice for a snack?
We need to think of snacks having nutrient density. We need to make sure that they're giving us some vitamins, minerals, and fiber versus what's known as an empty calorie snack that provides very little nutrients except just calories.
Also, should you be looking for ones that are low in sugar?
Yeah, I think that helps. I think the fewest ingredients, the best. Something that may be lower in sugar, but we need to make sure that if you read a label and it says low in sugar, to look at that ingredient. Some of them contain sugar substitutes, which some of us don't need or don't tolerate. I don't think children need that sugar substitute.
So how many calories per snack?
In general, I recommend around 200 calories.
How about fiber?
Fiber, we want to make sure at least a couple grams.
And how about fat? That's always the concern.
I think the most important thing is to avoid what's called hydrogenated or trans fats. Nuts are a great snack, even though some people know that they're a higher fat snack, but they're great protein and they provide the good mono and polyunsaturated fats.
So you just want to keep those to a minimum, though. I mean, not too many nuts at a
exactly.
point.
Exactly.
And so again, portion control there.
Yes, it's so important to always remember portion control with our snacks.
So let's get to what specifically do you recommend?
Fresh fruit, vegetables, getting that, even dried fruit. I eat a dried fruit and nut snack. I love high-fiber crackers, hard-cooked eggs, cheese.
And how about something like peanut butter on egg and apples? That's always been
excellent.
A favorite of mine.
Excellent.
And how often during the day?
I'd say a couple times. Again, just be aware of your hunger. If you're hungry between in the afternoon, you could have a mid-afternoon snack. In the evening, if you're hungry before bed, it's okay to have a small snack, but be aware that watching those TV commercials can make us hungry. We want to be aware that we're truly physically hungry and not mindlessly eating.
Especially if we're sitting in front of the television, sometimes we can all mindlessly eat.
Exactly. And we also, it's important we need our sleep. We don't want to eat just to be awake.
Oh, I see. So everything in moderation. Eat less processed snacks. Try for the healthy ones whenever possible.
Exactly.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
What's new in the treatment of childhood cancers? And please stay with us for our visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute Plan a Fit Trip. Business and family trips don't have to derail your workout routine. All it takes to stay active is a bit of research and forward thinking. Get informed about the place you will be staying. Do they have a gym, stairs, a pool, or a nearby walking trail? Bring appropriate workout gear and draft a sensible exercise schedule. Traveling in the near future? Start looking into your fitness options this week. If you plan ahead, you may be able to fit in fun excursions that count as both entertainment and activity. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Childhood cancer rates have been rising slightly for the past few decades, making it the second leading cause of death in children after accidents. And about 1,300 children below the age of 15 are expected to be diagnosed with cancer this year alone. Well, here to give us more perspective on the status of childhood cancer today is Sharon Bauer, a pediatric registered nurse and the nurse manager for hematology oncology at Upstate's Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you.
So childhood cancers are on the rise. Tell us about that.
Slightly. And, you know, we're not really sure where pediatric cancers come from, unlike adult cancers. That's a major difference. Adult cancers, a lot of time it's related to environment, sun, smoking, genetics, so breast cancer and history of cancer in your family. In pediatrics, we really don't know where it is coming from. We haven't found a link to environment except for high ionized radiation.
Meaning what?
Meaning Chernobyl.
Oh, so when you're really in some kind of nuclear.
Not a chest x-ray.
Mm-hmm. Or dental x-ray.
We do know that some of it is genetics. We know that, or chromosome abnormalities. We do know that certain children with Down syndromes are more at risk for leukemia, than their same age non-Down syndrome counterparts. A couple other genetic diseases like that that seem to be higher risk than a non-child with those genetic diseases. We do know that children with HIV, with AIDS, not just HIV, are at somewhat higher risk for leukemia.
But at this point, nobody really knows why there seems to be this slow, steady rise.
We don't know.
And the truth is, we may not really have the link, but it could exist in terms of environmental things. We just don't know that.
We don't know that. Correct. Correct.
So what kinds of cancers are affecting children? Tell us about the more prevalent ones.
So the leading pediatric cancers are the what I like to call the liquid, so the leukemias or the blood cancers. So acute ALL, acute lymphocytic leukemia, or AML, acute myelocytic leukemia. And you may hear those terms in the adult world, but the two leukemias in a pediatric patient, they're different than an adult patient with the same disease.
How are they different?
The way they react, their genetics, and what you treat them with, and then how curable. So, for example, ALL, which is our more common type of leukemia in pediatrics, it's all relative, but ALLs seem to be easier for us to treat in general than AMLs.
What ages are we talking about? What would be the typical time you might see ALL show
school
up?
School age.
So 5 and 6.
And those are 6 to 8 years old. And those are the children at that age group who seem to do better.
If a teenager
is diagnosed with ALL, that puts them at a higher risk because their cure rate isn't as good as maybe the 8-year-old with the same type of leukemia.
What other kinds of cancer are prevalent in kids?
So then solid tumors, brain tumors is one of the more common solid tumors in pediatrics, but that can be any pieces of your brain. So from your frontal lobe, which may change behavior, to your brain stem, which is our cure rate is not very successful with those.
And those require different treatments, obviously,
and
depending where they're located. And
correct.
Correct.
Yep.
And usually, what age groups do you usually see?
Pediatric cancer can happen at any age.
Sure.
We see them younger, so preschoolers, and then adolescents. Are the two. So usually the school-age kids, although they can get a brain tumor, we don't see them as often.
Are there other types
And the other solid tumors that we see are some children are born with retinoblastoma.
A tumor in the eye.
And that's highly, highly curable. Other children have, usually around 2 to 3, have something called neuroblastoma. Comes from, in general, nervous system. We've not been successful in moving that cure rate, so that's still hanging about 40%. Mm-hmm. But kids can get tumors of their kidneys. Common pediatric kidney cancer is called Wilms tumor, and that is rarely seen in adults and usually diagnosed 2, 3, 4 year olds.
How about lymphomas? You hear that a lot.
Lymphoma is usually adolescents.
And what does it mean to have a lymphoma?
It's another it's a cancer of the lymph nodes, lymphoma. But we're looking at that very similar to a leukemia these days. The research we're finding is they're acting very similar to the liquid or the blood cancers.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Sharon Bauer. She's a pediatric registered nurse specializing in hematology oncology. And we're talking about childhood cancers. They have been on the rise somewhat, and we do see a whole variety of cancers affecting children, some of which affect adults as well, but not, are any of these unique to children?
Really, Wilms tumor Tumor of the kidneys and neuroblastoma, because that usually comes about in their, again, toddler ages, to preschool.
The good news is, from the little bit of research I was doing, is that childhood cancers are still considered rare. I guess they make up less than 1% of all the cancers that we see that are diagnosed each year. So even though they're on the rise, overall within our population, they're somewhat rare. And the good news also is the treatments have become far more effective. Tell us about that.
Since the, I think in pediatrics, because it is a relatively rare disease, and there's a number of them, so they're all not treated the same. They're all actually treated different. And even with leukemia, as I spoke earlier, ALL, there is multiple different subsets of ALL, and they all have to be treated differently.
What are the main types of treatments that are being used? Is it similar to what happens in adults where you do surgery, radiation, chemotherapy kind of thing?
Yes. So if it's a solid tumor, we try and do surgery. Liquid tumor, so leukemias, there's nothing to do surgery on, so it's chemotherapy. Radiation, we do. That's usually with the solid tumors. However, radiation also kills normal cells. So, for example, it's hard to get chemotherapy across the blood-brain barrier. So we do give chemotherapy, but radiation is very effective in that. However, it zaps normal brain tissues, and we then can cause learning disabilities these children.
It's interesting because recently we've had one of our neurosurgeons, pediatric neurosurgeons, on talking about some of the newer technologies that they're using to zap tumors that are in difficult locations and to try to using laser.
Yes.
And trying to minimize the kind of damage that can take place with these kind of surgical procedures.
Right.
Or radiation.
And I think that is a good topic. That is why I think in pediatrics we've come so much farther than in adults, because we're working in conjunction with other specialists saying this works, how can we make it better, and then how can we make it better with less side effects. We know that every pediatric cancer survivor will have at least one, if not multiple, long-term health issues as they live the rest of their life.
They do. But what I'm reading, and help me with this, is the survival rate has really skyrocketed in terms of, it used to be when I was a child, I remember if someone got leukemia, it was a death sentence. And today, the way it's working is that you have up to 84% of kids will live 5 years or more.
Right. Just in my career, and I'm not that old, but just in my career, when I began globally, we were saying childhood cancer cure rate was about 40%, and now we're saying it's 80, 82% globally. So we have some retinoblastomas, close to 90% cure rate. Neuroblastoma, again, that's in the 40% cure rate.
I'm seeing actually that there's been a real improvement overall, though.
Right.
In all the cancers.
Yes, there is.
And so with that in mind, how do you approach parents? I mean, you deal with these kids every day. When a child is newly diagnosed, what do you say to parents? What's the approach that's most helpful?
So the approach is frank and honesty. We're the referral department. So your three-year-old has a cold for a really long time, and the pediatrician decides to draw blood counts just to see how things are, and they find leukemia cells in it, and then they're referred to us. So we need to be honest, and we use the word cancer. A lot of families still in 2013 don't like cancer.
Well,
but
it's frightening.
We need to use it. We're doing good things in the pediatric world and in the adult world. And then we have a wealth of specialists. We're specially trained on how to talk to not only the parents, but the children of all ages. So a three-year-old, their imagination is very active. So you might use play with them to kind of talk about how we're going to put an IV in, and it's going to poke, but we're going to help you, and we use diversion. We might use an iPad while we're putting an IV in them. for a 17-year-old, we're going to speak to them and say, you need an IV, it's going to be a poke, we're going to have to put a needle, and we'll use needle, in your vein, and we want to take some of your blood.
So obviously you're geared to treating the children and,
yes,
and knowing and how to treat the children and the family. But in terms of a hopeful outcome, in terms of the way you talk to parents, what's the approach? Do you generally...
It's always, you know, I think a lot of families, when they're first diagnosed, that's one of the first questions they'll ask is, what's the survival rate? What are my child's chances? And we'll give them real numbers. But you know what? We're treating these kids. That's what we do. And our treatment is the same that you're going to find in New York City or that you're going to find in Texas because we have the collaborative. And we've been working with the Children's Oncology Group to do this research for 40 years now.
I think that's a key point, I think, that you're just making, that you're involved in the same kind of cancer protocols that are being delivered throughout this country.
Correct.
By being part of this larger
Correct.
Collaborative. So if
Throughout
the world.
Yes.
So if you're getting treatment here at our cancer center,
right.
it's very much the same as you might get at Sloan Kettering
Correct.
Or anywhere else in the world.
Correct.
So the chances.
The things that those bigger institutions offer are the their investigational agents. But standard of care, we're doing it just like the other places are doing it.
Well, it's very, very hopeful information. I want to thank you so much. I mean, it's scary that there is a rise, and clearly we don't exactly understand why.
Right.
But the fact is that there's a lot of help and hope out there for
Right.
kids with cancer. So I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Sharon Bauer. She's a pediatric registered nurse and the nurse manager for hematology oncology at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with this week's selection. Some of our most engaging submissions come from younger writers. I'm going to read an excerpt from an essay called Living with Eugene. It's by Caitlin Provost, who recently graduated from SUNY Oswego. She writes about having to wear a brace to correct her scoliosis in junior high, a time when all one wants to do is to fit in. Her piece reminds us of how kindness can be its own miracle. Scoliosis sounds like pebbles rolling around my tongue. I play with the word, chew on it until it loses all meaning and is just a collection of syllables and noises. It's not a huge deal, the doctors told us. And yet I find pictures of girls with crooked bodies, collapsing lungs and heart murmurs in the little pamphlets the doctor gave me. Chronic pain, limited flexibility. It affects girls mostly, and Mom tells me about her mother, my Baba, who has it too. It's genetic, and I'm the first to have it this bad since her. I picture Baba's twisted back, hunched and sore. She has to sit down a lot because it hurts and makes her tired. She can't take a deep enough breath. I hear her wheezing in my mind, and the worrying begins again with a renewed force. Judy Blume didn't prepare me for this. Sure, I read Dini, but real life doesn't mirror the fictional world. Wearing a back brace didn't get my crush to realize I was the perfect girl, and I did not find, 200 pages into my experience, that it didn't matter if I wore the brace. My life has never been a young adult novel. Gym class in middle school is supposed to be horrible. Everyone going through puberty, stinky armpits, and awkward moments in the locker room. My sisters warned me about this. But nobody told me how to deal with being the girl who has to come in late and leave early so that I can store the brace in the school nurse's office. The girls don't ask questions when I come to the locker room late, but it's the funny looks I keep getting when I excuse myself early, the what's wrong with her, that bother me. I wish my friend Kevin were in this class because he'd be able to field the awkward questions and put the attention back on himself. But I don't know a single person here. And we are starting off with football. Melissa is on my team. She tells me I have a pretty good arm. Suddenly, we are sitting together during cool down and chatting like best friends. I get up to leave before class ends, and the teacher nods. Go ahead, she says. See you Friday. Melissa turns. Why do you leave early? My face burns and I fidget in my sneakers. Crap, I think. This'll be the shortest friendship ever. But I tell her about the brace. It pours out in a rush, a flood of words I can't stop. I tell her I've named the brace Eugene to avoid saying my back brace, that it sticks out bizarrely in the rear, giving me an extra shoulder blade, making people think I'm odd. I don't think you're odd, she says. A knot I didn't know I had in my stomach loosens, and for once I don't feel like a misfit. I smile and skip to the nurse's office, for once not even bothered by putting the plastic case back around my body.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us next week when we explore sleep disorders in adults and children. Plus, what does it mean when you have a fever? And also, what's the latest information on eating disorders? HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio, produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.